21st Century Radio is sponsored by Hieronymus & Company. This is Talk Radio 680 WCBM. It's time now for award-winning 21st Century Radio. Here's your host, Dr. Bob Hieronymus.
Welcome back to 21st Century Radio. This is Dr. Bob Hieronymus. Our executive producer is Laura Cordner, and our engineer is A.Y. Warshaw. There they go. It is time for miracles, friends. Human beings, yes, rules and regulations, 502 are. Human beings are not machines. We have an immortal component which is wiser than just about anybody you can imagine. Two, we're not alone in the universe, and we never have been. We live with invisible beings inside and outside of our bodies. Physical bodies, of course. And what we do to the Earth, we do to ourselves, and you know what we've done to planet Earth. UFOs have been a major topic for the past 22 years on 21st Century Radio. And from engaging case studies to examples of aerial sightings found both in the Bible and in classical art, the book we're going to talk about tonight, Wonders in the Sky, not only illuminates the mysteries that have gone largely unheard and ignored until now, it also explores how these sightings have played a significant role in the development of our popular culture, history, religion, and science. It's co-authored by Jacques Vallée, and he's one of today's most widely respected researchers of unexplained aerial phenomena. He earned his master's degree in astrophysics while living in France and holds a PhD in computer science from Northwestern University. Vallée is the author of several books about high technology and unidentified phenomena, including the seminal work Passport to Magonia, published in 1969, yeah, 60 years later. Now, he lives in San Francisco, one of my favorite places in the whole world. Chris Obeck, I believe that's how you pronounce it, Obeck or Obeck, has built the largest collection of pre-1947 unexplained aerial cases in the world. In 2003, he co-founded the Magonia Project, a remarkable network of librarians, students, and scholars of paranormal history on the Internet. The group has accumulated thousands of references, searched media archives in several languages, and collected hundreds of rare documents, scientific reports, and newspaper clippings. Obeck lives in Madrid, Spain. Welcome to 21st Century Radio, Dr. Jacques Vallée.
Hello. It's always a pleasure.
Well, thank you. Same
for
here.
For having me on the show.
Well, as I think our listening audience has heard me say many a time, there are two researchers in unexplained aerial objects whose work that I most admire, Phil Imbrogno, and yours as well, as you well know, Jacques.
Thank you. I only wish I had the answer.
Well, don't we all? Well, some people think they already have, Jacques. I mean, you know.
Well, yes.
And I think that's a big problem when you've already decided what the answer is when we don't have enough information on it.
Well, and that's a point where you don't need to do any research if you already have the answer. So, it's a field where there are no experts, actually.
Well, why did you want to do this book?
I had always wanted to do this book. You know, 40 years ago, you mentioned Passport to Magonia. The first two books I wrote about UFOs were pretty much oriented to, you know, what everybody believes, the extraterrestrial idea. When you first approach the subject, it's natural to think that, you know, these objects clearly seem to represent a technology, and that technology, you know, seems to come from outer space. So it's a logical idea. But then I spent a year in France where I had access to very good libraries and old medieval records and so on. And I started asking myself, when did this phenomenon begin? You know, which is, in science, when you're confronted with an anomaly, you try to look for patterns and you try to see, you know, when did it begin? Was it triggered by some specific thing? Most UFO books say that the phenomenon of flying saucers began in June 1947 when Kenneth Arnold, who was a civilian pilot, whom I met, by the way, saw six objects over Mount Rainier in the state of Washington. But the problem is we have records, we have sightings way before then, in the 20th century and in the 19th century, and Charles Fort wrote a number of books about cases from the scientific literature that were unexplained from before. So when I wrote Passport to Magonia, I drew a parallel between ancient cases in medieval records and so on, and the modern folklore of UFOs, not drawing any conclusions, but just calling attention to the parallels. But I knew I was only scratching the surface and that there was much more material. And I was sure that scholars would rush to their collections and their museums and so on and look for that kind of thing, the folklore experts and scholars in the ancient records. That didn't happen. A number of people pointed out that there were errors in my book, which was true. But there are always errors when you're trying to pin down some ancient things. But nobody has redone it until 40 years later. Chris Obeck, who is a much younger man than I am, is an Englishman who lives in Madrid, started a project called the Magonia Exchange. If you look it up on the web, you should look it up under Magonia Exchange. And he contacted me and he said, look, I've assembled all these records, and why don't we work together in tracking down the references and essentially going over the same territory that was in Passport to Magonia 40 years ago. So I was absolutely delighted to read that. I met with Chris in Portugal a few years ago at a conference on the consciousness and religion and science, and we merged our databases, because in the meantime I had accumulated a bunch of new old cases, and then we started tracking down references with the help of his friends on the web. And this is this has been made possible by the Internet. As you know, I'm a great fan of the Internet. I had the privilege of working on the early Internet, the ARPANET, when I was at Stanford Research Institute. And it's possible, the Internet made it possible in two ways. First, assembling a collaboration among these essentially 10 people all over the world who are tracking down these cases, and also having access to records of old newspapers and museums and so on and libraries, because now they are scanning all their holdings and putting them online. So it's a lot easier than, taking 5 years off and traveling from one little town to another looking up old records, which was, obviously impossible. So that's what led to this book, Wonders in the Sky. We wanted to accumulate enough cases that it would be statistically significant. We could say something about the patterns. And we identified 500 cases before 1879. And before 1879, there was nothing human in the sky. There were a few balloons, mostly tethered balloons, but there were a few free balloons, but everybody knew where they were. There was no dirigible, and obviously no airplanes, no CIA, no SR-71, no prototypes, none of that. So the sky was pure of human contamination.
Well, I think that's one of the strongest cases for this book. It's extraordinary. I mean, when I think of Stephen Hawking, I think you quote him as saying, I am discounting reports of UFOs. Why would they appear only to cranks and weirdos? That is a pretty shocking statement from an individual that should have known better, that should have read this material. There obviously, why hasn't science taken notice of unidentified aerial phenomena given the robust nature of this phenomenon?
In the case of Dr. Hawkins, who is, one of the great scientists of our age, he's a great cosmologist, a great astrophysicist. But that shows the mistakes that science can make when people speak outside of their field. I think he's simply not aware that many of the cases in our book came from astronomers. You know, two directors of Paris Observatory, Cassini and Le Verrier, a secretary of the Royal Society in England, people whose names are, you know, stellar names in physics, like Lagrange, great astronomers like Messier. You know, these people were in the 18th century and early 19th century. Astronomers were actually open-minded, and they liked to associate their name to the discovery or the identification of anomalies in the sky that could turn out to be something important.
Indeed.
New comets, new phenomena, the novae, supernovae, and so on. And they published what they saw very freely without fear of ridicule. We've lost that. Science has lost that. It's become probably because of the bureaucracy of science, the fact that you need to be respectable in order to get funding for your projects, and you cannot have the reputation of seeing unusual things in the sky. Mm-hmm. Well, you know, all of astronomy is based on seeing unusual things in the sky.
That's for sure.
And, one of the fascinating things in researching this book was to encounter and to track down the observations that earlier scientists had made and reported.
Well, that is why this book is so extraordinary. I've read every report you have in here, and yet I know you have more. You have many more than just this 500.
Well, we will continue. I mean, Chris and I see this as really the beginning of something, not the end. Mm-hmm. We've gone over the same territory as Passport to Magonia. We've done it with much greater precision. Thanks to a great extent to Chris's work. Chris is a scholar of philology, of the study of language and the study of history. He's extremely precise in tracking down references, and this book is really mostly his work. And I've added what I could in terms of screening the cases. Obviously, there were many cases we found that were meteors or comets or the aurora borealis, and other phenomena. And so, as the astronomer in the team, I screened out as many of the weak cases as we could, and then we ended up with these 500 cases. But we hope that this will motivate scholars and researchers around the world to go back to their archives. There's got to be a lot more. There's got to be much, much more, especially in countries where we don't have a good connection, like Japan and China, the Middle East, and so on, where people were keeping records way before Europe and, of course, way before America.
Well, while you and Chris Albeck do not claim that any of the events you have uncovered proves anything about flying objects from alien worlds or influenced by non-human intelligences, you have come to four major observations. Could you simplify those four major observations that you have on pages 11 and 12?
Yes. Well, this is actually confirming what we had, what had been hypothesized before, that throughout history there have been unknown phenomena in the sky that people saw as prodigies or celestial wonders, and they made a major impact on the imagination of the individuals who witnessed them. The number two, every period, every epoch has interpreted this phenomena in its own terms, often in religious or political contexts, and they still do. I think that's the main point. Mm-hmm. People have projected their worldview, their fears, their fantasies, their hopes into what they saw in the sky. And we still do that today. I think to a great extent, the expectation of aliens, of extraterrestrials coming here in spacecraft, is just the same thing. It's modern folklore. It's a projection of our expectations, because we are on the verge of going to other planets. Third conclusion, many details of these events have been forgotten or pushed under the rug of history, but their impact has shaped human civilization in important ways. You cannot understand human civilization without understanding the history of people observing things in the sky and hypothesizing about beings from the sky. And this is not from simply the UFO literature. I mean, this is, we quote in the book from scholars like Professor Culiano at the University of Chicago, from a number of people who have researched the history of religions. I mean, this is an accepted fact, way outside of our narrow field of research. Mm-hmm. And number four, the lessons drawn from ancient cases can be applied to the full range of aerial phenomena that are still reported and remain unexplained by contemporary science. I mean, people should realize that this continues now, and science does not have an explanation. You know, the media laugh at people who report UFOs, or they try to ridicule them. But the fact is that even if you can explain maybe, 8 or 9 cases out of 10, you're left with a large number of cases that are detailed, well-described, and unexplained.
Especially when you go back several thousand years, which we're going to do, and when we return on 21st Century Radio with our guest Dr. Jacques Vallée, Wonders in the Sky, Unexplained Aerial Objects from Antiquity to Modern Times with Chris Albeck, published by Tarcher. His website, Jacques Vallée, VALLEE.net, is linked on the front page of 21stcenturyradio.com.
Hello, this is Stanley Krippner. I'm professor of psychology at Saybrook Graduate School in San Francisco on behalf of 21st Century Radio, run by Dr. Bob Hieronymus. And I would certainly encourage listeners to stay tuned, because you will hear things on 21st Century Radio that you'll hear nowhere else on the airwaves.
Oh, it's always a great, great experience to hear Dr. Stanley Krippner. 50 years of relationship with this guy. He's an extraordinary soul. Our guest is Dr. Jacques Vallée, Wonders in the Sky, Unexplained Aerial Objects from Antiquity to Modern Times with Chris Albeck. It's published by Tarcher. His website is Jacques Vallée, VALLEE.net, and it's linked on the front page of 21stcenturyradio.com. Well, gosh, Rudy, as we used to say, alien contact may be mankind's oldest story. So let's take a look at some of your earliest sightings, the first being in the book 1460 B.C. in Lebanon, A Star Defeats the Nubians. Do you recall that sighting?
Yes, and this is the early cases in Egypt and in the Roman Empire and so on are very interesting, because they show how reliable these records are. And I expect that one of the criticisms of the book, of the research we've done, will come from people, including ufologists, who will say, well, you know, old records, who knows, this is, in the dust of history and it's unreliable, how do we know? Well, we do know a lot about those records, because people at the time were so impressed with what they saw that they either recorded it on what was at the time very expensive media, like papyrus or parchment, put it in their official records. Or in this particular case, in 1460 BC, actually engraved it in stone. So this is a stela erected in honor of Thutmose III, describing a fantastic celestial event during a war. And there was a battle going on with the Nubians, and what they call a star, an object, a bright object, came from the sky and positioned itself above the army. And the translation, which is, this is from a German Egyptological journal, which we cite. I mean, we've cited all the, we've tracked all this down to the earliest possible scholarly reference. The star positioned itself above them as if they didn't exist, and then they fell upon their own blood. Now the star was behind them, illuminating their faces with fire. No man amongst them could defend himself. None of them looked back. They had not their horses, as these had fled into the mountain, frightened, such as a miracle that Amon did for me, his beloved son, in order to make the inhabitants of the foreign land see the power of my majesty. Mm-hmm. So this is, you know, an Egyptian record of something that came from the sky and obviously was not a meteor, was not a comet, was not an aurora borealis, was something that created terror among the opposing army. So it was felt important enough to be recorded and to be the stela is on display in a museum, the Museum of Jardoum in Sudan. And there is no question about the date. We know when the stela was erected. We don't know exactly the date of the observation itself. And in this book we discounted legends. We wanted only cases that could be pinned down to a particular place and time. And hopefully the name of the witness. And in the surprising number of cases, we had all that.
Well, I'm just thrilled at the sources of information, and you're printing them right beneath the stories. This makes so much sense.
And well, you know, we look in the UFO literature. People have tried to do this before, you know, including me, and it was very difficult to have access to the original sources. Again, mm-hmm. before the internet, this was very hard to do.
Yeah,
and we've tried to track down all those stories and to correct mistakes. In UFO books, you'll find things like, you know, in 1810, two discs flew over London. Well, when you track it back to the original reference, it doesn't say anything about discs. But, you know, something happened. It says two lights were seen over London. And, you know, the UFO believers have turned the light into a disc. Well, obviously, we try to correct those mistakes. If it was a light, it was a light. I mean, that's what the witness said. It may or may not have been a disc, but we don't know that. Mm-hmm. We can't jump to that kind of conclusion.
Well, the second sighting, I was very excited by 1347 B.C. El Amarna, Akhenaten's flying disc. My wife and I worked in Egypt under President Sadat, especially in regards to the Akhenaten Temple project with Dr. Donald Redford. So I was just fascinated with this material in regards to Akhenaten's flying disc. What can you tell us about this?
Well, this, again, is engraved on the stela. The pharaoh Akhenaten was Amenophis IV, had an experience that shaped Egyptian history and history of the ancient world. He saw a shining disc that descended from the sky. And here it is, you know, the actual translation is a disc. And he heard a voice coming from what is referred to as a solar disc. That voice told him he had to build a new capital for Egypt and give it the name Akhetaten, the horizon of the solar disk. Now, he built a new capital for Egypt, also founded a new religion based on the worship of the solar disk. And we were, you know, fascinated with this because, again, there is an impeccable record of this, and the impact on history is very clear, and the impact on the history of religion is very clear.
So we go from Egypt, and then you come into Jordan or Israel about 850 B.C., shores of the Jordan River, an abduction of Elijah. And the reason why I wanted to specially note this was because there are a lot of parallels between these ancient cases and what goes on in abduction phenomena today. And we're going to touch on that but more. But the abduction of Elijah took place at 850 B.C. What can you tell us about that?
Well, our book ended up being containing a number of abduction stories that were, as you said, you know, very much parallels to the current, to the recent reports of alleged abductions, so-called abductions. And most of the abduction researchers, people like Bud Hopkins and Dr. Jacobs and so on, claim that abductions are a recent thing. In their theory, you know, we're being more or less invaded by aliens, and the aliens started abducting people 30, 40 years ago. And well, you know, abductions by beings from the sky is mankind's oldest story.
Yeah.
It goes back to the Bible. It goes back before the Bible, mostly in legends and traditions, older traditions. Certainly the American Indians have such traditions and so on. And all over the world you find it. Now, we did not pay much attention to that kind of story when it was not dated. We wanted actual cases that we could pin down and try to correlate with natural patterns, with, you know, with scientific patterns. However, in the Bible, which has, of course, many records of you know, paranormal happenings, there are a few cases where we do have a date and the name of a witness about whom we know something. And Elijah is one of those. The episode describes in the King James Version, "And it came to pass, when they were gone over, that Elijah said unto Elisha, Ask what I shall do for thee before I be taken away from thee. And Elisha said, I pray thee, let a double portion of thy spirit be upon me. And he said, I would ask a hard thing. Nevertheless, if thou wilt see me when I'm taken from thee, it shall be so. But if not, it shall not be so. And it came to pass, as they still went on and talked, that behold, there appeared a chariot of fire and parted them both asunder, and Elijah went up by a whirlwind into heaven." This is in 2 Kings. Well, this was felt important enough that it was, you know, that it was recorded in the document that is, you know, still read every day by people all over the world. And again, we have an indication that people believed in the reality of chariots, what they described as chariots. Again, every civilization has described it in its own terms: chariots of fire from the sky, taking somebody up into the sky.
Well, you also list the second abduction of Ezekiel, 593 B.C. How was Ezekiel's abduction similar to what today would be characterized as an abduction?
Well, Ezekiel is very interesting in many ways. We're not naive enough to believe that Ezekiel wrote the book of Ezekiel. Okay, the book of Ezekiel was written by scribes and monks who compiled it from a number of different records, including records that probably went back to the days of Ezekiel, but had been recorded by other people. And so the book of Ezekiel, as it is in the Bible, was actually compiled about 7 centuries after the death of Ezekiel. So we understand the history, and we understand the controversies about those records, and a lot of biblical scholars have studied all this. The observation by Ezekiel is remarkable in several ways. Essentially, he saw a strange craft. I mean, he describes it very much as a machine. not as a light, not even as a chariot, but really as a machine with wheels within wheels, a dome, brilliant dome, and four beings associated with it. And he was transported by it to a mountaintop, didn't know how he got there, and he remained stunned, in a state of stupor, which is very much what happens to people who describe abductions today. They describe being, and again, we make no hypothesis or conclusions about the reality of any of that. We really want to leave that to the reader because the material is just too rich and too, plentiful for us to draw any conclusions at this point. So, again, I'm using the word abduction because that's a word that is in the literature. It's a word that people understand today. Mm-hmm. Most abductees that I've known described a loss of the sense of reality during the observation and then finding themselves somewhere, not knowing how they got there, what had happened, often having lost time in the transition and being completely confused. And that's exactly what Ezekiel describes. There are other things that are strange in the peculiar in the record of Ezekiel. There are some words, you know how scholars analyze ancient writing. They put everything on a computer and then they provide, they do an index or a dictionary of the words and they look in what context words appear. And they compiled dictionaries of ancient languages for different centuries so that they can translate, for example, a Coptic manuscript of the 10th century and compare it to an Arabic manuscript of the 12th century and put it back into context. So when you do that with Ezekiel, you find that he uses words that are used only once in the entire Bible, including the word, there is a word that is translated as beryllium or beryl when he describes a machine. He describes a dome, the brilliant dome of the machine. Well, actually, that word is used only once in the whole Bible, in Ezekiel. So the translators had to really guess at what the word beryllium is, as I understand it, is just a guess. There are also words that are not used anywhere else in the language of that particular period. So, obviously, he was grasping at words trying to express what he had seen. And what he had seen were wheels within wheels and these four beings. And, it does remind us of many modern descriptions of witnesses who saw disc-shaped or wheel-shaped objects that they had trouble providing a good description of.
Well, we're going to take our final break of the hour, friends, and you're going to get a chance to win a copy of this 500-plus page book, which contains so many wonderful, I wouldn't want to call them stories, but accounts throughout, thousands of years. This is a book, in my opinion, that should be in this is the kind of book that should be in every library in our country, especially within the school system. That's the kind of book that should be in at least high school and, of course, college, of course. But I think that this is a great reference book from that standpoint. And when we return, we're going to find out that there's not just aerial phenomena or crafts being reported in the skies, but also visions of fighting armies. Boy, when I saw the cover of this book, and so did my wife, we looked at it and said, "Ah, boy, I can't wait to read this." Yep, and thank heavens we did. We'll be back with our guest, Dr. Jacques Vallée, Wonders in the Sky, Unexplained Aerial Objects from Antiquity to Modern Times, with Chris Albeck, published by Tarcher. His website is Jacques Vallée, VALLEE.net. Is linked on the front page of 21stCenturyRadio.com. Next week on 21st Century Radio, The history of spiritualism is intertwined with the history of American independence. The human quest for mysticism has, in fact, shaped the American identity. Sunday night at 8, 21st Century Radio, Talk Radio 680 WCBN. Well, free books and prizes just for paying attention. Here's what you could win on the 21st Century Radio quiz. A whole library of books, including Wonders in the Sky, Unexplained Aerial Objects from Antiquity to Modern Times by Dr. Jacques Vallée and Chris Ulbeck, and Their Impact on Human Culture, History, and Beliefs by Jeremy P. Tarcher. Go to jacquesvallée.net. And, of course, that's up there on 21st Century Radio, of course. And a whole lot more, about 15 or 20 items altogether. Just be the first to answer this simple question. What was the name of our first guest on 21st Century Radio last week? Tell us the name of our first guest on 21st Century Radio last week. And if you're first, you'll be our winner, but you need to qualify. Here's how you do it. If you know the answer to this hour's quiz question on 21st Century Radio and you have not won from us in the last 60 days, call in now. 410-922-6680. That's 410-WCBM-680. First with the right answer wins. Prizes are available for you to pick up at the WCBM studios in Pikesville after Friday of this week. Winners have 60 days to pick up the prizes and must wait 60 days before winning another prize from 21st Century Radio. Good luck.
Hello, this is Ingo Swann, the author of Penetration, the Question of Extraterrestrial and Human Telepathy, and you're listening to the wonderful 21st Century Radio with the amazing Dr. Bob Hieronymus.
Actually, that's the amazing Ingo Swann, an extraordinary soul. Boy, we haven't gotten together with him in I don't know how many years. I know Stanley Krippner certainly misses him as well. Well, our guest is Dr. Jacques Vallée. The book is Wonders in the Sky, Unexplained Aerial Objects from Antiquity to Modern Times with Chris Ulbeck, published by Tarcher. His website is Jacques Vallée, VALLEE.net, and it's linked on the front page, 21stCenturyRadio.com. Well, Jacques, there are so many great accounts in here, but you know, when we saw, my wife and I saw the cover of this book, I thought to myself, that's the book for me. Will you tell us what's on the front cover here? Hold it up to the microphone.
It's not an authentic, it's a composite of, it's not an authentic and ancient engraving and so on. We do have actual engravings describing aerial phenomena within the book. This one was a composite that was drawn to represent the frequent descriptions of entire armies of seeing flying discs in the sky that very often were described as flying shields. I mean, most shields, they were square shields, but many shields were round. So when people saw flying discs in the sky, they occasionally described them as clipi volantes in Latin, the flying shields. And that's, a dramatic scene, and that's what the publisher put on the cover of the book. It certainly accounts for a number of observations that were made and were recorded. Again, people may say, well, we don't know the context of this and so on. But these came from official records, from either religious records or government records. In Rome, in the Roman Empire, the consuls made a rule, a law, that every year they had to be presented with a record of all the unexplained phenomena in the sky, or any unexplained aerial object in the sky. And this was not, about UFOs. It was for astrological reasons, because it was felt that unusual things in the sky would announce the future, would announce future wars and revolutions and the death of kings and the rise of new empires and so on. So those records... This is a little bit as if, President Obama was asking the Secretary of the Air Force to give him a quarterly report on his desk in the White House on any UFO over the United States. And these records have been, some of them, many of them have been preserved. Some of them have been lost, but some of them, again, were copied by historians and preserved in their writings. So they've come down to us.
Well, the one on May, in 21st of May, 70 A.D., flying chariots surround the city. I mean, this is from Flavius Josephus. This is, you know, the quality of this individual himself and his work. I think, really, it's very credible. Could you tell us a little bit about that the flying chariots that surround the city?
In one of the books of the Jewish Wars by Flavius Josephus, in the history of the destruction of Jerusalem, and what he writes, and here we quote the actual text, on the 1 and 20th day of the month Artemisius, a certain prodigious and incredible phenomenon appeared. I suppose your account of it would seem to be a fable, were it not related by those who saw it, and were not the events that followed it of so considerable a nature as to deserve such signals. For before sunsetting, chariots and troops of soldiers in their armor were seen running about among the clouds and surrounding cities. Now here we have, again, this is not a vague report. We have the place. The place was Jerusalem. The date was the 21st of May, 70 A.D., and we know this was before sunset. This is a description of, you know, what you would call a vision of things in the sky. We don't know how physical it was, or if it was, you know, a projection of an image. Why people saw it this way? We know that in many of these cases, the perceptions of the witnesses are altered. And what they see, you know, in some cases is different from what was there as a physical reality. But this is, again, this was not a meteor. This was not a comet. This was not ball lightning. This was not any of the physical phenomena that people have quoted as explaining UFOs. We had to sort through a lot of that material to compile this book, and for every case we kept, we rejected 4 or 5 or 10. Mm-hmm. That, you know, in the records, in the Roman records I mentioned, many, you know, it's like the Air Force files. You know, as you know, I spent about 4 years in my spare time going through the files of the U.S. Air Force. And 8 or 9 cases out of 10 could be explained. And here's the same thing, but you're left with 10% or 15% of the cases that are not explained. And here is certainly one of those cases. The astronomers, of course, find that extraordinarily valuable because in those Roman records, there are comets and there are meteors, and you can go back and complete the statistics back in time. For example, the period of Halley's Comet. I mean, Halley's Comet had already been seen, and you can compute a better, you know, period for the comet by being able to go back to those ancient records. In fact, we checked every case in the book against a large standard astronomy textbook called Cometography that records all the comets in antiquity, you know, and down to the 19th and 20th century. So we checked every case, asking whether it could have been a known comet, and we kept only those that didn't fit a comet pattern.
Well, that was May 21st, 70 A.D., but you have accounts, many accounts, 1608 in France, of the flying warriors. Then you have July 3rd in Switzerland, 1612, battling sky armies. Wonderful illustrations of these. And then the one that I wanted to focus on before we get to the end of this hour is this. April the 8th, 1665, in Germany, a domed flying saucer of which you say, quote, "There is no question that this account is authentic, although the date may be incorrect by a few days." Could you please review that particular case in April the 8th, 1665, and I think it's Stralsund, Germany?
Carl Sund, yes. And this, the man who did the research on this is Hillebrand von Ludwiger. And I spent about a week with him when he came through San Francisco, and we reviewed the case together, and he really showed me the research he had done on this particular case. This happened about 2 p.m. The fishermen of Stralsund first reported a big swarm of starlings, of birds, flying in the sky, coming from the north over the sea. That changed to a vision of ships in the sky that seemed to be fighting one another. Again, we have this phenomenon of what seems to be a vision projected in the sky, and a lot of smoke in connection with this vision. And then all that vanished, and one of the people there was a writer. Again, you have to realize that in those days there were very few people who could read and write. So the records we have come from scholars who were the people who were educated, and one of the witnesses was writer Erasmus Franchisi, who says, and I quote, "After a while, out of the sky came a flat, round form, like a plate." And this is, again, an exact quote. Okay, this is not my interpretation of it. This is the actual 17th century text. "Looking like a big man's hat, its color was that of the rising moon, and it hovered right over the church of St. Nikolai. There it remained stationary till evening." Now, again, this was not a meteor or a ball lightning or plasma. I mean, it remained stationary from 2 p.m. to the evening. "The fishermen, worried to death, didn't want to look further at the spectacle and buried their faces in their hands. On the following day, they fell sick with trembling all over and pain in head and limbs." Now, as you know, in the UFO literature, you find in the modern cases, many cases where witnesses had after effects, a physiological effect. If you remember in the movie, in Close Encounters of a Third Kind, the witness has a sunburn, and people describe strange effects after the sighting. We find the same thing in these ancient records of again and again and again, people feeling disoriented, people feeling paralyzed, people feeling sick in the following days. Here they fell sick with trembling all over and pain in head and limbs. I mean, this suggests almost a neurological effect.
Yes.
And so these cases are very detailed. This is not a vague legend.
No. It's not.
So what the fishermen saw was a plate with a dome, and it was orange, yellow-orange like the rising moon, and hovered, was motionless for a long time.
Well, when we return next hour, we're going to find out, of course, Dr. Jean Follet already knows, he's not going to find out. There were some legendary folks that have seen some of these craft. We'll touch maybe on Columbus, maybe on Michelangelo, maybe on Nostradamus, and we certainly should, St. Agobard. Is that how you pronounce his name, Agobard?
Yes, Agobard.
Oh, what an account that was. We'll be back with our guest, Dr. Jacques Vallée, Wonders in the Sky, Unexplained Aerial Objects from Antiquity to Modern Times with Chris Albeck. Tarcher Publishers, his website is jacquesvallee.net, and it's linked to 21stCenturyRadio.com.
Around the clock and breaking news now on Talk Radio 680 WCBM Baltimore and WCBM.com.